Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Thursday afternoon, and I'm delighted to say that we have New York Times columnist Frank Bruni with us this hour, which means that our conversation will be wide-ranging. He's written about America's mood recently, saying we're a country surrendering to a new identity, an era in which optimism is quaint and the frontier anything but endless. He asks, what is the American dream in 2014? Is it swirl away nuts for a leaner tomorrow? The worst is yet to come, so insure yourself if you're among the lucky few who can. He wrote a very insightful piece about politics in Colorado, asking whether drillers and environmentalists can peacefully coexist, whether a country bloodied by gunfire can muster any sane response. He also highlights the good, Plato and the promise of college, a three-week program at Columbia University, where most of the students are minorities. Undergraduate mentors from Columbia are paired with New York City kids who hope to become the first in their families with college degrees. And the name of the course is Freedom and Citizenship in Ancient, Modern, and Contemporary Thought. He wrote a beautiful column about the Little League World Series, Mo Davis and her coach. Her coach is quite a guy. So here's Frank to talk to us. He's an op-ed columnist for the New York Times. He's been in that position since 2011, joined the newspaper in 1995, was chief restaurant critic for a number of years, and a Rome bureau chief. He is the author of Born Round, a memoir, and Ambling into History, a chronicle of George W. Bush's campaign for the presidency. Came to the Times from the Detroit Free Press and was one of the staff writers for the Times Sunday magazine for several years, where he profiled many prominent politicians and entertainers. We'll be welcoming phone calls for Frank because of the nature of his column. He covers many things quite profoundly, so we'll move from topic to topic, but he can talk about just about anything. I guess the overall theme is America in 2014. Are we lost in America? Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook page, leave messages there. That's fine. That's the Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're also on Twitter at K Dunn Show. Hello, Frank.
Hey, how are you?
You know, it's fun to talk to you. I do read you every week, and the words that you write frequently find their way onto the air here. So, just
well, thank
so that
you, for
you
that.
Know, yeah, we you write so beautifully about so many things. So, I appreciate your work, and thank you for joining us. Let's start with something that's pretty upsetting. You're lost in America, and you've had several themes on this in the last few months. We're sour on the president, the Democratic Party, the Republicans, most of all. We're hungry for hope, but we don't spot it on the menu. We're living in a time that's unusual in your lifespan, in all of our lifespans, kind of depressed.
Yes, I mean I think so. I mean I'm 49 going on 50. You know, so my historical memory doesn't go back super far. None of us have a memory that goes back that far. But I feel I remember, of course, the Carter years and stagflation and the gas lines. And I don't know if you were I don't know where you were, Kathleen, or if you were alive then or watching that. Okay. And I think that's an interesting point of reference because that was another phase of my life when I do remember America feeling kind of very weak and uncertain. But if you go back and you look at how long that went on, and then you kind of look at some of the statistics today, we're living in a period where the pessimism of Americans has been unusually durable. We're going on something like over a decade of people saying in polls, more people thinking the country's on the wrong track than on the right track. You can find many moments in the last decades of American history where people say that, but I don't think you can find a period where for 10 years running that has been the consistent answer. I think Andrew Cohet with the Gallup and Pew organizations has said there's only three moments in this century we're in now where Americans expressed a whole lot of confidence about the country. One was right after George W. Bush was elected. I think that said less about the election than about that time. That was a very sort of good times election, if you remember. People weren't incredibly apprehensive in 2000. Subsequent to that, the only two times were right after 9/11 and right after we invaded Iraq. And if you look at those moments, those are moments when people are willing themselves, you know, into a national spirit because there's a big thing on the line. And the fact that you can't find any other moments when people were feeling any discernible confidence about the country's direction, I think that's really troubling, and I think it's really significant.
Yeah. And part of it may have to do, you've written a lot about the economy, too, on this day when fast food workers are on strike in many cities of the country. You talk about a friend, and you call him one of the smartest men you know and one of the most devoted dads. You asked him if his children would live in a more prosperous America. His response, you write, was no. How do you make peace with that? And his answer, I'm hoping to leave them a lot of money, which many people can't certainly afford to do. But there is that sense of things aren't going to be better for my children, which is very sad.
I'll tell you where you really see that in a big, big, big way. We've all read a lot about, and we know in our lives, how frenzied the competition to get into elite universities and colleges is.
Mm-hmm.
You know? A lot has been written about this. I've written a lot about this. All of it true. In fact, I'm finishing up a book that's sort of about this. And I've been paying a lot of attention to that and to why it's become so cutthroat to get into Harvard, Yale, Amherst, whatever. I mean, you go down the list of the, you know, 20, 25 most selective schools according to U.S. News and World Report. And I've spoken over the last couple months in the course of doing this book to many, many academics, university presidents, people who watch this. Whenever I say, what is that about? Why is it so much more frenzied, cutthroat, anxiety, you know, anxious, all of that than it was 20, 40 years ago? Every person, either their first or second response is, because parents aren't confident that their kids are going to be living in an America of plenty. And they want to make sure than parents, and parents have always wanted to make sure they gave their kids every leg up, every competitive advantage. But their sense of the stakes is much different. They really feel like this national pie isn't going to grow, and that making sure their kids get an adequate slice of it has a greater urgency around it than ever before.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, I think that's one of the mirrors, that college admissions frenzy of a country that is no longer confident that there's plenty around the corner.
You also wrote a column that made my jaw drop when you talked about the essays that were written by some of the students.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, let's talk about our lives in ways that we don't want to hear about.
Right. That's the nexus when kids write these overly confessional essays.
Right.
That's the kind of confluence of the nervousness and anxiety of doing something to impress the admissions committee and get into the university. And it's the confluence of that and the just general oversharing of the Facebook and Twitter era.
Mm-hmm.
You know, social media have completely changed what is considered appropriate to share and inappropriate to share. People share everything.
You write about, this comes from something that you read, a branch of the World Bank, that the Chinese economy may overtake ours by the end of this year, which seems to me really enormously significant, but I'm not sure why it seems so significant.
Well, first of all, I did mention that in a column, but I also mentioned that that's an estimate that's widely disputed. Most people think that's a couple more years away. You know, I mean, if not even 5 or 10, it's significant. Let me back up a little and tell you about something else that I think I mentioned in that column. For something like 6 years running, when Gallup has asked Americans, who's the world's economic superpower? What country has the world's greatest economy? A majority of Americans have said China.
Mm.
That's incorrect.
Mm-hmm.
But think about that. For more than 5 years, Americans who once felt so supreme, whether that was a good thing or not, have been laboring under the misimpression that we no longer have the world's biggest economy. I think that tells you an enormous amount about how Americans feel about the country and how they kind of assess the country's, you know, strength. And I think it's significant just because it runs counter to what has so long been our national identity. You know, when you go back through American history, we are the country of the endless frontier. The sky is the limit. We
Right.
get to the moon, all of that stuff. Built into our national character is a sort of epically can-do spirit and an optimism that tomorrow will be better than today and my kids will do better than I did. And that is not the way most Americans talk about themselves anymore when they're asked questions by pollsters, when they sit around and assess their children's fates.
Are we a country that still looks to politicians or maybe in some other profession, somebody to lead us out of the light? And so we thought that President Obama would do that when he was first elected. We're looking for people in government to take care of our woes, to lead us to something better?
I think it's human nature to look for people to lead us to something better. So I think, of course, we still do that. I think everybody does that, across the globe in different ways, sometimes with disastrous consequences, as we kind of see in what's happening in Iraq and Syria right now. People do want to follow. They do want someone to show them the way. What I think is getting interesting and very sad here is I think people's belief that a politician, that any politician can do that, I think that belief is waning rapidly. It's not Barack Obama's fault. A lot of hope was invested in him for a whole lot of reasons. He has disappointed in some ways, but he has been frustrated and and blocked in many ways. But I think the cynicism about government is, statistically, and you can just feel it when you talk to people around you, it's at an all-time high, that cynicism, or an all-time low, maybe we should say. And I'm really curious to see what happens, because we have an election coming up, the midterms, and the midterms are happening in a context of pretty much unprecedented pessimism about government. And yet the political system is so sclerotic, the whole way in which it works with name recognition and money being so important, that my guess is we're going to look up the day after the midterm elections, and as was the case 2 years ago, you're going to find that 90% of incumbents, in the House and the Senate have been returned to office, or something close to that, maybe 85%. And I don't know where that ultimately is going to lead us, because people want something new. And yet the options they're being given are just old versus old, or also familiar, that they're not finding a way to make something new happen. And I wonder where the building frustration over that is going to ultimately lead us.
Take us to Colorado for a moment. You, on August 16, wrote a piece, A Battleground and Bellwether, which was an interesting piece, because you've got this state that I imagine we'll be paying a lot of attention to. And I love what you said here, that we've got this country that's so divided. We've got drillers and environmentalists, and whether or not those groups can coexist, whether or not gunfire can muster any sane response. And politically, all of this is playing out in Colorado in some really interesting elections.
Yeah, Colorado, I think, is one of the most fascinating political laboratories in the country right now, maybe the most fascinating one. It is, I think, the only state that has an electorate that's divided pretty much evenly, one-third Republican registration, one-third Democratic, one-third not affiliated or registered with either party. Mm-hmm. That in and of itself makes it a sort of like open game there. It's a state that has had an enormous number of young people move to it over the last decade. I think maybe more young people have moved to Colorado than to any other state. And so you have a new generation of ideologies and politics, and yet you also have, people, you also have retirees there. You have a lot of very traditional people there. Colorado has, on the one hand, Boulder, and you probably can't find a more liberal city in the country. And then it has Colorado Springs, which is a longtime stronghold of Christian conservatives. So it is this petri dish or laboratory or whatever you want to call it, where all of this stuff is competing. And on the environmental front, Colorado is a state with enormous resources in terms of gas, oil, and all that, which many industries are in place trying to maximize that stuff, exploit it, make profit from it. But Colorado is also a hugely outdoorsy state, where a lot of these young people have moved to enjoy the outdoors, and a lot of them are environmentalists. So you have a lot of different strains of things that are trying to work themselves out in Colorado.
Zero in on the 6th Congressional District, where you write about the Hispanic vote and some interesting things that are happening to woo that vote.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you have a candidate in the in that House race. The Republican incumbent is someone who has in the past been for English-only legislation. He's taken very tough lines about immigrants, stuff like that. He's being challenged by a very popular Democrat who's bilingual. And who has a great relationship with Hispanic voters. Colorado is one of the states where the Hispanic population has risen sharply, as it has in a mirror of the country over the last decade. And so the Republican incumbent in that race is actually taking weekly Spanish lessons.
Oh, my goodness.
And talking about that publicly. And it's a fascinating turnaround.
Right.
For he's a politician who was once associated with very harsh anti-immigrant views, and now he is making a point of letting everybody know that he's learning Spanish. I think it's a sort of parable for the country because we have a rapidly changing electorate when it comes to the Hispanic vote.
Mm-hmm. The places where you find great promise and tenderness and people doing wonderful things, I love those columns as well because we sure need to be uplifted. The column you wrote about the coach of Monet Davis, what a terrific human being he would appear to be. The column that you wrote about these minority students who are being paired with mentors from Columbia who are taking this very rigorous curriculum this summer to be the first in their families to go to college. There's so much goodness happening, but it's, you know, not where we're normally looking for heroes.
Yeah. No, I mean, that's very well said. I think thank you for mentioning those columns. I really appreciate it. It means a lot to me, and I think it's important for those of us who are in the business of and should be calling out all the problems we have and wringing our hands over some of the things that aren't going well. I think it's incumbent upon us to identify some of the heroes and talk about the things that do go well. One of the things that really gives me hope is I think most Americans, I sound like a politician here, but I do believe this, I think most Americans are really good, decent people.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's a lot of distrust about the way government spends our money and what it does, you know, with our goodwill when we give it our goodwill. But I think Americans left, you know, on their own, in their communities, you know, when they're navigating their own lives, I think more people than not do decent things. They want economic fairness. They realize how important social mobility is to our country. Both of those columns you mentioned were about efforts, you know, one by a man through sports, you know, another by Columbia University through a program it runs, to really be engines of social mobility and to make sure that, you know, kids with enormous talent who just aren't born into circumstances as privileged as, say, I was, you know, have some sort of chance, you know, to make that talent grow, to have a bright future. If we end up with a country in which people don't believe upward mobility is possible and in which people don't believe there really is a way to climb the ladder, we're in big trouble because it not only will destroy our civic spirit, it'll corrode the very kind of central narrative mm-hmm. of this country.
Frank Bruni is our guest this hour, op-ed columnist for the New York Times. I'm sure many of you, like me, read him regularly. He is always worth reading and has thoughts that stay with me for a long time and columns that stay with me. And if you listen to my show regularly, you know we bring up some of his thoughts fairly often. Well, what do you make of what we've talked about so far? Let me make this broad, but you can take it any way you want. Would you agree that we're kind of lost in America right now, that we're all, what was that, Simon? Who's saying that song? We're empty and aching, and we don't know why. But that was Paul Simon, wasn't it? Empty and aching, and you don't know why. We would love to hear from you. Here is our phone number, 800-486-8655. And because we're so close now to midterm elections, what happens to that angst that we have right now? How does it get translated politically? Can we predict it? Or is it because it's so unpredictable where we are, if we're going to vote, how Hispanics are vote, if African Americans are going to turn out to vote, when our ideologies are so different here? What direction are we going? Or are we just so down that we don't care? We would love to hear from you. We have no phone lines open right now, but you can send a message on email or wait for a line to come open. Our number is 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. We're also on Facebook, where we love to read your comments. That's the Kathleen Dunn Show, and this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Frank Bruni, the wonderful op-ed columnist for the New York Times, is our guest this hour, and we'll go to our phone calls now. We have many of them, starting with Rich in Rhinelander. Hello, Rich.
Hi. Well, during your break, there was a promo for a concert that the band was trampled by turtles, and somehow it seemed very, very appropriate in terms of the first topic. I just want to laud, praise the good sense of the American people. I mean, if you ask any human being to be all things to all people, they generally get weakened. Usually it's a her. And right now, The United States is engaged in a kind of end of the imperium military adventurism all over the world. It sounds as though, from your guest's first comments, Mr. Bruni's first comments, that our economy is identifiably faltering in terms of its position in the world. And so I'm just saying I'm in agreement. I'm not happy about it, but I'm in agreement that with others who say, yeah, regulated capitalism may work, but when you have this unregulated machine where people believe in the invisible hand of the marketplace, and then there are these bubbles that burst with regularity every 10 or 12 years, and you get wiped out financially, that's just stupidity. That's not American know-how or American smarts, and I'll end it there.
Thanks, Rich. Frank.
Yes.
You're on.
I'm on. Oh, no, I didn't.
Your response.
I didn't know if there was a question in it. I'm sorry. That's why I. Yeah. You know, I mean, there are. I mean, on the subject of regulation, whether we're talking about, you know, financial market regulations or other, I mean, there are ways in which we probably don't have enough regulation. There are also ways in which we perhaps have regulations that are choking us. I think there's a whole lot more to this picture of economic trouble than just the regulatory, you know, whether we're talking about financial markets or whatever. I mean, I think we've got a real education crisis in this country, and we know that, you know, and we seem unable to muster the response we need to for that. I mean, our kids in international tests, when we're looking at where American kids, how they fare against kids in other countries, they don't measure up the way they should in a world in which having the right skills and being educated is going to be the best global edge you can have. Things don't look great for us on that front, and I think we're seeing some problems in our economy from that right now. We have horrible infrastructure woes. There was a terrific story that I would urge listeners to go back and read in the Times either yesterday or the day before by our LA bureau chief, Adam Nagurney, where he looked at Los Angeles in particular and California also as a kind of metaphor for the nation's infrastructure. And in the years of the recession with the tightened budgets and all that, we have lapsed ever further behind on our infrastructure. That's going to be a huge economic disadvantage and a huge economic burden if we don't fix that. We've had opportunities in Congress to devote some money to that. We've not been able to do it because there's just such a lack of agreement and so much obstruction in Congress. So I don't, you know, I mean, your listener who phoned in was focusing. I mean, his comments sounded very Wall Street focused. I think it's about much more than that. I think our problems are much more varied than that.
Mm-hmm. Well, how many of the problems you talk about schools, Frank? And we do a lot of shows on education, and people are always bringing up Finland. Finland is great. They have a lot of money. They have great teachers.
Please.
But then when you look at what's happening in America, we just have a huge number of people who are living in poverty in this country.
Forgive me for rushing in, but
sure,
right. At some point you'll read a column from me that says enough with the Scandinavia comparison. You were correctly mentioning that Finland gets brought up.
Right.
Finland gets brought up in large part because there's a terrific, terrific book by Amanda Ripley, I think her name is. I mean, sometimes I forget this. A Time Magazine education reporter. I don't think she's with them anymore. Called The Smartest Kids in the World. I think mm-hmm. I've got their. And she looked at a number of countries that had made enormous educational strides. And she looked at Poland. I believe she looked at South Korea, if memory serves me. One of them was Finland, and that's one of the reasons Finland gets brought up. Finland also gets brought up because one of the conclusions that's been reached about its educational achievements is that it has both paid, you know, financially compensated teachers and given them an amount of social veneration that has lifted their status in the country, that has attracted some of the best and brightest to teaching. And there are definitely some lessons for us in that. I mean, right now, if you look at statistics, most of the people who go into a public education, go into being teachers, K through 12, they're not at the top of their classes. They don't see it as a profession that is going to accord them a lot of respect. It's certainly not a profession that is going to financially remunerate them lavishly. And so we have to look at that, and Finland's a great example and model. But back to the Scandinavia thing, you know, we're an incredibly large, over 300 million people. We have lots of immigrants, and proudly so. We have enormous racial diversity, and we have enormous economic diversity. None of the Scandinavian countries that get held up on as various examples have any of that. So to believe that there are solutions in Scandinavia that apply for us is just ludicrous. It's apples and oranges. The countries are too different.
We go next to Patty in Eau Claire. Hi, Patty.
Yes, hi.
Hi.
This is a fabulous topic, but I have a little different perspective. I absolutely agree that America is lost. I believe it's in decline, and it's not going to change. It's not going back. It will change. It's not going to go back to the way it was. But there are a lot of people in this country that, and around the world, that are thinking about a theory called conscious evolution. We're the first species in the history of life on this planet that can understand that we can destroy ourselves. But we can also be creative and understand that we can change and make things better. And I think it's time to drop the idea of competition and individualism and sovereignty, and it's time to look at cooperation and globalism and partnership. And that is happening, not with our leaders. Not with our leaders. They have to fall, and I trust that they will. And I think the near future is going to be very hard, but I trust the next generation and beyond. They're dropping the traditional American dream and looking at something bigger, something that provides happiness, not just materialism. And I say we need to support them 100%, and I'll listen on.
Thanks, Patty. Thank you for the call. Frank.
I think a lot of interesting stuff in those comments. Thanks for that. For one thing that sprung to my mind as I was listening, it is absolutely true and vital that we begin to understand, or that more Americans begin to understand, that that self-interest is not diametrically opposed to civic interest. You know, I think we have a lot of people who vote what they believe to be their self-interest, but don't realize that if what they're voting kind of works against the good of everyone, it's ultimately not going to be beneficial for this experiment of ours called America. You know, if people are so, I mean, let's take this economically, for example, if people are so tenacious about holding on to their piece of the pie, even at the expense of somebody else getting some, that's not going to be good for the country or for them in the long run, because we're not going to have a country that is kind of peaceful and cooperative and stable if too many people in it feel utterly disenfranchised and hopeless. So it's in all of our interest to make sure that all the boats rise, as politicians always talk about, you know, lifting everyone. Well, that's you know, not just a locution. If everybody's not lifted, if we don't try to make sure that everybody's lifted, the experiment as a whole will fray and fracture, and I think a little bit of that is happening right now. I'll stop there.
When she brought up the word, Frank, which we hear over and over, but for some reason when she said it, it struck me that I was thinking about it in terms of its reality, and it just doesn't seem to be happening, and that's cooperation. And I'd like for you to spend some time talking about these times in which we live when people are at each other's throats. Nobody can get along with each other in Congress or in the state level. In the state of Wisconsin, you know, we've got people one side or the other side. They don't talk to each other. They don't agree on issues. This idea of moving everybody up and cooperating with each other is non-existent as far as I can tell. Maybe it's existing somewhere.
I mean, it exists in some places, and we mentioned Colorado earlier, and actually Colorado's governor, whom I admire, John Hickenlooper, has had some very interesting bipartisan successes in that state. You know, and on the state level, in a couple of places, you see some shining examples of hope. You know, one thing I think it's important to bring up that doesn't get mentioned enough when we're talking about this lack of cooperation, this triumph of self-interest, and this inability for people in different ideological camps or in different tribes of society to communicate, we need to look at the way people are using the internet. We need to be conscious of the way we ourselves use the internet, and we need to really talk about getting people to use the internet in a different way. The internet, to me, is the transcendent irony of modern life, because it theoretically speeds you to more viewpoints, more information. It opens up the universe and all of its diversity to you in a way that nothing has before. But that's not the way it turns out people have used it. People, whether it's the Twitter feeds they follow, whether it's the websites they bookmark on their homepage. Most people use the internet to customize the news they get, to customize the culture they participate
yes.
in, to customize all of the input, so they end up marinating in a much more thorough way in their established perspective on every front, social, cultural, political, and they end up more set in their established ways of thinking and less able to communicate and thus, getting back to that word, cooperate with other people. And one of my most fervent wishes is that everybody would just stop for a moment, go to their computer, change a few of their bookmarks, diversify their Facebook and Twitter feeds, and just realize that you're never going to be able to talk to people who are different from you if you never hear from anybody who's different from you.
Good point. Nick in Brilliant. Hi. Nick, are you there?
Yeah, hi.
Hi, Nick.
I think you guys, at the beginning of the show, when you talked about American attitudes and about, you know, the American dream and how people are dissatisfied and whatnot.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's a healthy attitude and a healthy shift, because I think we are contracting as a country, and we need to, you know, I think it's realistic. I mean, we're not gonna, you know, we're older, you know, we don't have these, you know, frontiers, like you said. And, you know, I don't think it's good, but I think it's realistic, and I think, I know, and you were comparing us, and you were saying apples and oranges, but to Finland, but I was thinking more of, like, the European countries, how they've, it's like, yeah, and then they've changed, they've got alternative energy, they've, you know, I'm not saying that it would definitely happen, but, I mean, it seems realistic, and that, you know, we have limited resources. We can't go on forever the way we're going, and, you know.
Yeah, well, that's an interesting point, that some of what we're talking about requires some drastic changes on our part, other countries as well. But does it, Frank?
Well, I mean, limited resources, one immediately thinks of you know, of energy and the sort of consumption of fossil fuels and all that, and that's certainly true. One of the challenges we face is, you know, and we could even bring global warming into this. I mean,
mm-hmm.
one of the challenges we face is we do live on a planet that it's a finite planet, you know, in various ways. It has certain unchangeable physical realities, and it has certain exhaustible supplies of things. I mean, we're overfishing oceans, all that sort of thing. So we do need not to see limits necessarily as a bad thing, but as limits as a thing that kind of makes us behave in a more conscious way. Your listener also used the word contract, and I think one of the open questions here, one of the things that concerns me is, do we necessarily, when we're talking about our economy, when we're talking about our national wealth, do we need to accept contraction? You know, a lot of our politics right now seem to be about how to divvy up a pie that is now suddenly presumed to be finite. We used to talk a whole lot more about growing the pie, about growing our economy. And it's not clear to me that we can't grow our economy. I know this, though, we cannot grow it if we can never find any agreement in Congress, if we can't move anything forward. You know, I'm not taking the president's side in the following thing, but there have been infrastructure bills proposed, there have been jobs bills proposed. We all know we need to do some things along those lines. Maybe the legislation that has been debated hasn't been perfect, but we're doing nothing. We're getting nothing through Congress that represents any sort of proactive attempt to battle contraction and to grow the economy. We've grown the economy in the past. The economy still grows, albeit very, very slowly. Before we say, like, what limits do we have to accept, I think we need to think about, you know, whether we're putting limits on ourselves that we don't need to, simply because we've got political inaction and an era of pessimism.
Yeah. Thank you very much for the call. Let's talk about the president for a moment here. You took him to task in a recent column just a couple days ago, September 1st, when he was asked, or he made the statement last week, we don't have a strategy yet for dealing with Islamic extremists in Syria. You say not having a strategy, at least a fixed, definitive one, is understandable. The options aren't great. The answers aren't easy, and the stakes are enormous. But announcing as much, it's hard to see any percentage in that. It gives no comfort to Americans. It puts no fear in our enemies.
Yes. I mean, I believe, yeah, I wrote that this week, and I believe that. I felt that with the "we don't have a strategy" comment that Obama made, and then the very next day, I think even more interesting and maybe more troubling was he was talking to donors in New York, but it was there were media present. I mean, he realized or should have realized these were comments that were going to travel beyond that room, talking about what was going on with ISIS in Syria and Iraq, the beheadings, the crucifixions, all of it. He said, you know, the world — I'm paraphrasing, but he said, you know, the world's always been messy. The Middle East has always been messy.
Right.
This isn't as bad as the Cold War. I'm not sure what the point of saying that is. Americans are feeling very fearful, understandably so. We've seen some horrible, horrible, horrible things happening over there.
Mm-hmm.
We don't really know how quickly containable or ultimately containable that is. I don't understand, just as I don't understand what's gained by saying we don't have a strategy yet. Keep it to yourselves, you know. Project public confidence and then work on it behind the scenes. I don't see what's gained by comments that almost seem to minimize the anxiety and the horror of the moment. And I feel over recent weeks as if the president has not done the kind of job he needs to communicate the message in the public realm that's most constructive.
Yeah, it is a frightening story. And the other thing that I wonder about, just being a talk show host for a number of years, it wasn't that long ago that we were talking to terrorism experts, Frank, on the air, who were saying, well, our counterterrorism efforts have been splendid. We only have, you know, a few hundred terrorists in Pakistan or wherever they happen to be. And all of a sudden, you have this huge, awful organization that appeared from where and why, and we don't know all that much about it, it would appear to me. How did that happen?
I can't tell you how it happened. But, I mean, I think on some level, everyone knew it could happen. I mean, this is a very... the president used the word messy. I think that's too light an adjective.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this is a very chaotic, roiling area of the globe. You know, you do not have stable states. You have a lot of people who feel completely alienated from their states. You have an enormous amount of rage. You have an enormous amount of religious extremism. I mean, it's a recipe for this kind of thing. And just because you stamp out the leaders of one organization doesn't mean people aren't going to step up to take leadership of that organization in their stead, or that there aren't going to be other organizations that spring up for some of the same reasons and then some different reasons. I think we're going to be dealing with this for a very, very long time.
Yeah. Depressingly so. Frank Bruni is our guest this hour. Frank, an op-ed columnist for the New York Times. He's been doing really important columns since 2011, joined the newspaper in 1995, and was chief restaurant critic for a number of years. Did he get tired of eating, or how do you make such a change? We'll have to ask him that. He was also Rome bureau chief. He's the author of Born Round, a memoir, and Ambling into History, a chronicle of George W. Bush's campaign for the presidency. And as you heard him say earlier on, he's currently writing a book about getting into elite universities and the state of elite universities in this country. If you'd like to join us, we'd like to hear from you. We're talking about an overarching theme, and that's whether or not America is lost this hour of our show. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Email talk at WPR.org. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. And this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Frank Bruni is here for the remainder of this hour. Ed in Green Bay is our next caller. Hi, Ed.
Hi.
Hi.
I'd like to thank Mr. Bruni. His columns are excellent. You're absolutely right about that. But I suspect that he mentioned earlier about Americans going in and changing their bookmarks to more, general news sites. My question would be, would one of those news sites be the New York Times? I'll remind him of Judy Miller and how the New York Times was nothing more than a cheerleader going into the Iraq war. And then, of course, there was Jason Bloom, who just made up news stories.
Jason Blair.
And my point is that the establishment is more than just our elected officials. The establishment is the editors and writers, like your guest at the New York Times. They condone this kind of thing. And by the way, that happy moment he mentioned when George Bush was first got into office, so I'll remind him that it took the Supreme Court to overrule the state of Florida and stop the recount. We came close to major political upheaval.
All right, Ed, thank you. And yet he likes what you write, Frank. You got to take the first part of the
comment. No, I don't take anything personally. I think right. That may have just been the kind of spoonful of sugar before the medicine went down. Well, first off, I did not say I did not personally say it was a happy moment after George Bush was elected. I was simply reporting on what the three moments were, according to one pollster, when Americans expressed greater happiness than dissatisfaction. He's absolutely right about that election. I'm just telling you what the pollster said about the morning after and what Americans were saying. As far as saying people should go in and change their bookmarks to general news sites, I didn't say that either.
Right.
What I said is go in and change your books, your bookmarks and your Twitter feed and your Facebook feed to diversify the sources of information you're getting. What concerns me isn't that enough people aren't coming to the New York Times or the Washington Post or any establishment news organization or news entity. What concerns me is the number of people who have bookmarked only 6 conservative blogs or only 8
right.
liberal blogs. What I'm talking about is making sure to read and listen to and hear stuff that is not just a reinforcement of your predetermined perspective, but that gives you an alternative viewpoint, something that challenges your thinking, and at least a glimpse of the way other people feel. And a glimpse of the way other people feel that's not a caricature of the way they feel. I mean, you get descriptions in liberal places of conservative viewpoints that are caricatures. You get descriptions in liberal places of conservative viewpoints and their caricatures, and all of those things only serve to divide us further. So I'm talking about diversifying your feeds, not adding the New York Times to that feed. I personally think our virtues and our accomplishments way, way eclipse our sins over time, though
Absolutely.
Those sins are many. So I think it would be a great idea if more people came to us, but I'm content if they don't come to us but just diversify their feed.
Yeah. Well, you're still the paper of record. There's no doubt about that. So
we're also one of the few places that gathers news with the kind
right.
of with the kind of sweep and budget mm-hmm. and earnestness that we do.
Yeah. So do you want to give us a couple suggestions of places we should go? We've never been before, Frank.
Well, I mean, it depends on who you are. My whole point is, like, if you are marinating in an only liberal perspective, add some conservative stuff. If you're marinating in a conservative perspective, add some liberal stuff. If you're somebody who on TV is just watching 8 different cities' locations of The Real Housewives, you know, mix that up. I mean, part of the problem is we live in a country where there's so much, you know, culture, so many blogs, whatever, that once you find something that hits your sweet spot, that tickles you in a special way, you can do nothing but that. You can watch 20 hours of Law and Order of various iterations. You can watch you can watch Duck Dynasty, and then you can get 3 books by people. You know, that's the way our culture increasingly
right.
works. It lets people create these ruts. And what I'm saying is get out of your rut. I will tell you one publication I think that's worth going
All
to
right.
Because it's speedy and it includes links to both sides. There's a publication called The Week.
Yes.
And it's a news weekly of a sort, but it really is a summary and a distillation of the week's news
mm-hmm.
rather than a magazine of its own. And one of the things it does is with each big story of the week, it gives you a quick several paragraph synopsis of events. And then it presents for you in paraphrased form what liberal columnists said
mm-hmm.
about it, what conservative columnists said, and it gives you links if you're reading it online or on a tablet so you can go to those original sources. And if you just sort of began there and followed their branches and went back to the places they're citing and didn't just follow the liberal path or the conservative path, you would get the kind of diversity and array of perspectives that I think would serve everybody.
Thank
well.
You, Frank. That's good advice. We will take your advice. Thank you. Ron in Rome is next. Hi, Ron.
Hi, how you doing?
All right, how are you, Ron?
Well, I'm doing good. I'm sorry. The prank just kind of makes me laugh. I listen I don't watch much TV. I watch MSNBC mostly because I guess that's the groove that I'm in. I think that their knowledge is pretty more honest than Fox News. But I just listened to the whole last 20 minutes. We're not, I don't see the country in a funk. I don't see them. I live out here in Rome, in the country, Sullivan, outside of Milwaukee. I go by all these farms. Everybody's working. Everybody's doing their job. I'm sure there's a few people out of work. I don't think the election of George Bush was, although I voted for him twice, I don't think that turned out to be a good idea. I think that idea of going to Iraq or going to the Middle East and trying to enter this religious sect came out for a bad idea. I think that's where ISIS came from. That's where the Al-Qaeda, Taliban, they all came from that area. And they did hit us. They did hurt us when they did 9/11, and I hate that. But what I don't think it would be that bad if everybody's saying that we're, what do we need to get us all galvanized together, is going to be something else. It's going to be some kind of adventure that we all need to take part in. So.
All right. Thank you, Ron. Can you imagine what that adventure may be, Frank?
I'm not really sure what Ron means by an adventure.
Yeah, I'm not either.
I mean, I got the feeling he was warning against or concerned about a military engagement,
right,
or a military adventure, for lack of a better word, that would be an either distraction or a rallying point. And I think that if what he's saying is we need to beware of beginning such a commitment or embarking on such of an adventure merely as a way to feel strong and united, you know, I couldn't agree with him more. That's not the proper motivation for military engagement abroad. The Iraq misadventure, certainly in hindsight, seems like something that was terrible and that we're still paying the consequences of. It doesn't make the coming decisions any easier, though. We remain, one thing I think it's important for people to realize is, in the same way that we cannot be cavalier about military engagements, we cannot be cavalier when we're putting people's lives, young lives, you know,
yes,
soldiers' lives on
right.
the line. We can't ignore the fact that we remain the world's lone superpower and that the world is a place with, you know, forgive my locution here, I don't mean to be melodramatic, but the world is a place with plenty of evil. And there will be moments when we as a country that I think wants to be, to a certain extent, the world's conscience and is proud to have many values that are exemplars, there are going to be moments when we have to step up against evil. I don't know that we're at one now. I can't predict when they'll be, but I don't think we can be shy forevermore about any sorts of foreign engagements. Some of them will be well chosen and wise, and we just have to kind of evaluate everything on a case by case basis.
Yeah, thank you very much for your call, Ron. So, how did you go? I notice every now and then there's, you know, marinating or sweet and sour in your
language.
So, I guess the restaurant critic hasn't left you completely. But isn't that an unusual change to go from restaurant critic to writing the kind of column, or was that always in you and you just became the restaurant critic for whatever reason?
Well, the unusual change wasn't going from restaurant critic to what I do now. The unusual change was ever becoming the restaurant critic. When I became the restaurant critic, I had been a journalist, a reporter, a writer for, I think, almost 20 years, and I had been at the Times for over a dozen years when I became the restaurant critic. I think that's right. I may be getting the timeline a little wrong. And before restaurant critic, I had reported from Rome on mostly non-culinary matters. I had covered a presidential campaign, I'd covered the White House, I'd done all that sort of stuff. So the oddity was the five years that I was restaurant critic, and that was just a reflection of the fact that pretty much over the course of my whole career, I've done a lot of different things.
Mm-hmm.
I'm the ultimate generalist as opposed to specialist. I spent a year and a half at the Detroit Free Press reviewing movies. That was my job. That was my last job at the Detroit Free Press before I came to the Times, where my first job was covering religion on the Metropolitan desk. So I've always been kind of resolutely all over the map.
Well, restaurant critic is a pretty good gig for a while. I get to eat well.
It is. Yeah. It is. But you, I did it for a little over 5 years, a little under 5.5 years. It's a great, great gig in many ways. But at a certain point, you run out of synonyms for succulent, moist, or tender. And you realize that if you use succulent one more time, you know, someone's going to come down and do something. So,
right.
So I reached my succulent ceiling, and I had to move on to less succulent areas of writing.
Well, stay where you are. You're really good at it. Frank, thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Frank Bruni, our guest, op-ed columnist for The New York Times. He's been in that position since 2011. And we read his stuff pretty regularly, and I think he's definitely worth reading. So his advice, go to The Week, and you can get all points of view. All right. It's good advice. Thanks to KP Whaley for producing this hour, and thanks to KP as well for on-air production in our studios in Milwaukee. If you didn't get on the air, if you want to go to our Facebook page and leave your comments there, we'll read them. We can all read them. That's the Kathleen Dunn Show.